freedom. The greatest thing about this country, whether you agree with me or not, it's the absolute truth. If you take this away from any person or any group of people, you have no country. Freedom. You have no religion. You have no sound money. You don't have any of it. You're subject to the control of the people who have taken your freedom away and who are now subjecting you to their will, because that's what lack of freedom is. Being subject. You know what subject means? To someone else's will. Freedom means you're subject to your own will. As long as what? As long as you take responsibility for your actions and you never hurt the person or property of any other human being.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show. Yes, still hoofed off the FM airwaves, but here we are on the People's Republic Stokescroft web stream, live web stream. If you'd like to see us back on Bristol Community Radio, you can just go to our website at thisweek.org.uk. Go to the contact page and you can contact directly the chairman of the BCFM board and also the managing editor, Pat Hart, and let him know what you think. Should we be back on the airwaves or not? Anyway, it's Friday, 5 o'clock, and I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is author of 9/11 Revealed, Ian Henshaw, and Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. The Charlie Hebdo terror trials this week. So why has it taken 5 years for the French authorities to get their story straight and bring those arrested to court? 5 years, yes. And as Russian dissident Alexei Navalny lies sick in a Berlin hospital, apparently poisoned with Novichok, we ask, what is US spy Vil Saltonovich Miryazov? What is his role in the decades-long Novichok story? Is it actually as dangerous, this stuff, as we've been told? And what about Alexander Litvinenko? Remember him? Who's also supposed to have been poisoned by Putin back in 2006. Only his brother, his sister and his father don't think he was. And the British inquest only said he probably was. Did he ever really work as a spy, Litvinenko, or was he just a former policeman trying to sell protection to gullible Western visitors to the newly opened up Russia? And more to the point, trying to blackmail criminal oligarchs in London? That could have gotten him killed by them indeed. And next week, it's the anniversary of the 2001 9/11 attacks, with the official story in pieces and evidence pointing to the Israeli Secret Service in conjunction with traitors within the US government and military being behind the attacks. We get the views of former psychological warfare officer Scott Bennett, airline pilot and author of The Big Bamboozle, Philip Marshall, who died in suspicious circumstances, producer of the In Plain Sight video, Dave von Kleist, and we also hear the testimony of National Security Advisor on the day, Richard Clark, all under the expert eye of author of 9/11, The New Evidence, who's joining us here in the studio. And a medieval satanic group infiltrating all the monotheistic faiths, hell-bent on privatising the earth so they can buy it up for their own private property. An English king that stood in their way and had his head removed for his trouble. Author of The Dying God, we heard last week from David Livingstone, giving his view on the origins of the Jewish Kabbalah. One of the world's best scholars and authors on the topic, I think, author of Transhumanism, The History of a Dangerous Idea. David Livingstone, this week on the Rosicrucians and the role of Francis Bacon and John Dee in paving the way for the militant atheist establishment behind the British Empire. But do you know what? Joining me to review this week's news is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and also author of 9/11 Revealed, Ian Henshaw. Welcome to the programme, both of you.
Hello.
To start with this week, Martin, I think we should ask you about what you make of the resignation of a chap called Paul Smith. He's a Labour Party member. He's on Bristol City Council here as the Cabinet Member for Housing. By resigning, he has potentially put the City Council in quite a lot of trouble, leaving on the committees at the very least the Labour Party without a majority potentially.
Well, I don't really know what his reasons are, and no doubt we're going to hear, because I believe you've done an interview with him. If he hasn't resigned as a councillor, then it won't obviously change the committees. If he's resigned as a councillor as well as being in the cabinet, then it will. And since I don't know which is which, it's hard to comment.
Actually, I know you're from the South Coast, Ian. Yeah. You've had a similar sort of thing going on in Brighton. I wonder if you've been following that, where various people have been... Actually, in this case, he's resigned, but you've had Labour Brighton councillors expelled from the party, leaving the Greens in charge of Brighton.
Yeah, the Greens are back in charge in Brighton due to self-mutilation by the Labour Party. It seems that the... purge, you know, the witch hunt against anybody who doesn't agree with 105% of the Israeli government's opinions is still no longer welcome in the new Labour Party.
Martin,
even if it means losing a council.
Amazing, isn't it? I mean, it doesn't look as if they're going to lose Bristol, Martin, but it certainly isn't the most intelligent thing for the party to be doing, to be getting rid of members for anti-Semitism or any other reason, if it means they're going to lose they're cutting off the nose to spite their face.
Well, I believe Harriet, second name I've forgotten, was...
Harriet Bradley.
Yeah, she was suspended at one stage for supposed anti-Semitism, but she's still in the party. I think she's just suspended.
I understand she's still suspended, actually, and so that's one of the reasons why this is so difficult, because she's not actually officially a party member. You know, it's meant that that Paul Smith going too, hasn't actually resigned yet. But anyway, it's put quite a lot of pressure on the Labour Party in the city. They're only just hanging on by their fingernails now.
Well, they're hanging on by their fingernails in the sense that they won't have a majority over all the other parties anymore, potentially. But don't forget that Marvin is still the mayor, and under the Tory rules, the mayor decides everything anyway.
So what's the point of electing councillors when the mayor's deciding everything?
Well, that's a good question. I don't believe in the mayoral system, but then there we are. The Tories and the Liberal Democrats decided it was a good idea.
Okay,
and that's why we've got it.
As I understand it, the rules are different. The Local Government Association have information on the legal position of local authorities between council committees and full council. So when full council meets, Marvin Rees gets an extra vote, who's the mayor, as well as all the councillors, and also Joss Clark, who is the Lord Mayor or Mayoress, she doesn't get a vote. So by that means, by your extra Marvin Rees vote and one less Liberal Democrat vote because of the Lord Mayor, at full council, it looks as if the Labour Party will still have a pretty two-seat majority, but it's on the committees that it's going to change. But anyway, let's have a listen now to the Labour councillor Paul Smith, who I spoke to yesterday about this. I mean, he basically, although he says he's retiring, I asked him, well, this is really a resignation, not a retirement, Paul.
I'm Paul Smith, Cabinet Member for Housing at Bristol City Council. And there are 13,000 households on the council's waiting list. There are 600 families in temporary accommodation, 280 homeless people in hotels at the moment, and also house prices average 10 times earnings. So housing is a huge issue in this city in many ways. Also, one in six of Bristol citizens live in council housing.
A lot of people will be looking at this and saying, well, actually, you've ditched your responsibilities by resigning. You say you're retiring, but actually that's not really the right word, is it? You're well below retirement age and you're taking up another job.
I'm leaving the council to take on another role. I first retired from the council when I was 34, so I don't think it's an age issue, really. I mean, it's anybody who's in a role, something else comes along, and then they move over to it. And I think that it's fairly normal.
But some people will look at it and say, well, you, Paul, have done all you can at the city council. There's no more you can do. And that's one of the reasons that people leave jobs of responsibility like you've got. It's because they don't feel they can achieve any more in that role.
Or they feel they can achieve more in another role. So in terms of my role at the council, I feel that I have achieved quite a lot and actually made many of the changes that I wanted to make in terms of the culture of the housing department, the significance of the housing department within the council. Got a new director in who's now driving forward on that agenda. In terms of housing delivery, we've got the council through its council housing and its company, Gorham Homes, has got a pipeline of over 2,000 homes that it's building, meaning that the council will be the largest developer, residential developer within the
city. But hang on, these pipelines actually largely consist of just land with no housing on it, and you could be accused of land banking.
I think that that's completely unreasonable. There, we have to go through the planning process the same as anybody else. As soon as we get through planning, we start on site. I mean, we've been, I think, tremendous at actually getting sites built out very quickly, particularly, say, compared to both the private sector and the housing associations.
Can you point to one or two sites in the city that you think are kind of jewel in the crown that you would say is a good job that you've done whilst you've been doing housing here?
Yeah, there's the what was the elderly person's home at Broom Hill, which we've demolished. There's now 13 homes there with people living in them. Just down the road from there, there's another 5 bungalows that we've built. Ashton Rise, which is our first estate, if you like, of 133 homes. There are now people living there. It's still being built out, but there's absolutely no land banking. There's a couple of sites in Henbury, which between them have over 50 homes with people living in them. We can point to quite a large number, actually, of sites that we've developed, and we've moved very quickly on.
People in the Cabinet, in the Labour Party, and particularly the Mayor, Marvin Rees, will not be happy about what you've done. You've rather dropped them in it, leaving them with great doubts about whether they've actually got a majority and that they can control the city anymore now.
I don't think that's true at all. In terms of the full council meeting, the Labour Party still has a majority of 2 votes on the council. And as they always used to say, one is enough. So I don't think there's any credibility to that accusation.
But once you've left, Paul, there won't be a majority, will there?
Once I've left, there'll be a majority of 2 in the council. The Bristol Post have reported claims by Councillor Tim Kent saying at the full council meetings there's an equality of votes, which there isn't, because there are 34 Labour councillors plus the mayor has a vote as well. So that gives Labour 35 votes. The other parties have 34 councillors, but one of those is the Lord Mayor and therefore doesn't vote, which means the other parties have 33 votes. So 35 to 33 is a majority.
But you've left them on a cliff edge, Paul. You shouldn't be pulling out. You've let the party down.
I don't think I've done that at all.
Well, many lay people were thinking, actually, at the moment, we could do without this resignation. And you're a bit selfish. This is just a career move for you. Actually, it's left the lay people wondering whether they can hang on to control of the city.
Well, funny that nobody from the Labour Party has said that to me. And I've had communications from over 100 Labour Party members congratulating me. So I don't know where you get your information from, but I don't think it's at all true. And as I say, Labour has a 2-vote majority in the council meetings.
Can you tell us about this job you're moving to and how it compares to your old job?
It's actually a paid employment. It's a job rather than being a politician. And it was never my intention to hang around the
council.
Well,
hang on, you get paid as a politician.
Yeah, we get an allowance as a politician, but I haven't got an employment contract. The current role I have as a politician is that I can advise on policy. I can advise officers in terms of the way I want them to take the housing service. I can't instruct. I don't manage anybody, whereas I move into a role where I'm chief executive of a housing organisation where I have executive responsibility for managing an organisation. So they are quite different in their function. The organisation that I'm moving to is called Elim Housing. They currently own and manage 800 homes from Birmingham to Devon and into Newport, but with a sort of concentration of housing in Bristol and South Gloucestershire. They provide standard housing, also supported housing, housing for homeless people, housing for homeless single parents. They manage traveller sites across the southwest of England. So they provide a wide range of different housing services. they're not at the moment a very large developer. It's quite difficult for small associations to compete with the larger ones, but they've got a small but steady development program at the moment.
But surely, you know, as part of the council and the Labour Party, you could do something about policy. You could change the direction of the ship. All you can do working for a housing association is actually build the houses. You can't actually improve the whole situation, Paul.
Well, I think it's wrong to think that housing associations only exist to build houses. If you take Elim Housing, where I'm going, they manage 800 homes. They house over 1,000 people. I would say you start with the quality of service to the people who already live in your homes rather than focusing on what you can build. I mean, I've worked in the housing association sector for over 30 years. And so, in a sense, coming onto the council was an interruption of that work. I never intended to stay on the council for more than two terms. We've had this term extended because of COVID. An opportunity has come up within the city, which, I mean, this particular role, the last time it came up was 30 years ago. So these opportunities don't come very often. And I've taken the decision to take advantage of that opportunity.
What about the travellers? Because there's a lot of people wondering why the council is pursuing an injunction at the moment against travellers in St Werburgh's.
My understanding is that the injunction that's been served in a part of St Werburgh's is van dwellers rather than travellers. And you'll know that there's quite strict legal definitions of Gypsy Romany travellers as opposed to people who live in vehicles. The reason that the council is taking an injunction for that area of St Werburgh's is the level of antisocial behaviour which has been reported by residents in that area. So in some respects, it's very similar to the action that was taken in Greenbank. We've also offered people alternative places to pitch their vehicles. So they're not being criminalised. They're just being asked to vacate a particular area of road space.
I mean, the travellers themselves will say that the sites they're being offered are way too far out of town. And you know, if they're cycling into work every day, you know, it's an impossible place to put them.
As I say, I mean, you keep using the phrase travellers. I don't believe that they are travellers. I believe that they're people who live in vans. So the sites that we're offering are further out from the centre of the city. But of course, there are lots of places where people can park a vehicle closer to the centre of the city. And in many places, people are living in vehicles. There are no problems particularly caused by that, and it operates fine in a fine balance between those people and the residents who live in houses and flats.
It seems a bit unfair to do this to the travellers on the 1 year during the pandemic when none of them are away at festivals as they would normally be.
Well, firstly, most of the festivals are finished by now. I don't really understand the point. The issue is not about stopping people living in vehicles or parking up on parts of the city. It's about the level of antisocial behaviour that's been caused, which has disrupted the lives of people living in that area.
Well, why is it that the Bristol City Council is employing this barrister and paying for them out of the waste budget rather than the housing budget? Surely these are people that need housing rather than fly-tipped rubbish.
So I don't know about the employment of the barrister or where the enforcement arm of the council comes not under the housing department. It comes under neighbourhood enforcement. So I presume it's funded through the council tax. It's not the enforcement function is not a housing function. So I think you'd have to address that question to Councillor Steve Pearce, who's responsible for enforcement rather than me.
What's your legacy going to be, do you think, Paul, doing housing in the city? Because I think quite a few people have said that at least the council is now building council houses again.
I would like to hope that there are several legacies. I think one is the re-emergence of council housing. within the city, which is not just about us building more, although that's really important. It's also about us improving the service that council tenants get, which there's a large piece of work on making that service much more responsive to local people and to our tenants. But also we've got plans to work with tenants on some of our existing low quality estates to rebuild them, so that we will have a major new generation of council housing across the city. That's one. I think the other one would be the massive growth of community-led housing within the city. We've worked with the community-led housing sector, and across the city, they've got plans to build 1,000 homes. One of the biggest schemes in South Mead has just received planning permission. There are other applications in for sites across the city, and people taking control of their own housing issues through community-led housing. I think Bristol is seen as being at the forefront of that, and I'm sure that will continue, because whilst I've helped facilitate it there, it's not down to me, it's down to scores of people across the city who are really passionate about meeting their local housing needs themselves.
Okay, Councillor Paul Smith. At the moment, still just about housing position on the Cabinet. Thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, thanks, Tony. You take care.
So that's Paul Smith there, Martin. I mean, you've got to think to yourself, well, maybe he just feels that maybe he just feels that he's done all he can now, and that the next year would be a waste of time doing housing in the City Cabinet. He's much better to go out and become a chief executive of a housing association, where he's got actually a little bit more control himself, rather than having the mayor staring over his shoulder the whole time.
Well, not necessarily about the mayor staring over his shoulder. Basically, he made the case there that he's basically done the job. He wouldn't, I mean, if there'd been an election in May, that would have been, you know, he might have been re-elected, but he's decided he's going to move on. And, you know, that's up to him, isn't it, really?
Certainly is. Okay, so let's talk now a bit about COVID. I mean, this is the story which sort of has taken the whole world over, really, hasn't it? The world's gone mad. I sometimes look at it and I think, what's happened here?
We're all experts on viruses now, aren't we?
Supposedly, yeah. I found quite interesting to see at the massive march that there was, rally effectively in Trafalgar Square last Saturday. I was listening intently to Radio 4, listening through at 5 o'clock, where they talked about a march in Berlin on the 5 o'clock news bulletin on the BBC network Radio 4, where they were saying there were 18,000. The later reports, or certainly reports from Germany, were saying it was more like 50,000-60,000. And they didn't mention the Trafalgar Square march at all. So before we actually go to Trafalgar Square and hear a little bit from there, I'd just like to get comments from both of you on how the BBC can be commenting on a march in Berlin, where there's actually almost as big a march in Trafalgar Square that doesn't even get a mention on the news, Martin.
Well, I didn't follow any of the news reports about it, apart from on the internet, just with half an eye. So what the BBC did or didn't do, I can't really comment on, because I don't know what they said.
Well, I just told you, they didn't report on it at all at 5 o'clock.
Well, I mean, but I definitely saw about it myself. But I'm generally an internet news person. I don't generally follow.
Isn't there a certain aspect to this where they don't actually want to see it, Ian?
Well, I think they you can bury things. The BBC is such a huge organisation that they carry surprising stories, surprisingly interesting stories that we'd be, you know, I'm going to mention some later if you like me to. So, you know, I wouldn't necessarily infer that they didn't mention it anywhere. You'll probably find some little, maybe the local Trafalgar Square, you know, area broadcast.
Maybe Newsroom Southeast did, you know, which covers the region. It's a region for that part of the world.
The fact was, this was an interesting national demonstration which should have had wide coverage on the BBC, but apparently didn't.
Maybe they were getting their story straight. Who knows? Of course, this is civil servants. It does tend to be quite bureaucratic. I mean, when I worked there, sometimes, particularly when there was a war starting, everyone would be very, very cautious about, must check this with the editor, must check this with the editor. And there wasn't a lot of letting journalists off the leash or producers. But anyway, let's have a listen now to Anna Breeze. She's a former BBC journalist, and she was down at Trafalgar Square last Saturday.
So why have you come today? because of all the corruption. I cannot understand how people cannot see that it's a load of rubbish. I'd like staying indoors lowers your immune system drastically. Staying away from people lowers your immune system drastically. Wearing a muzzle does the same thing. How can we possibly listen to our government? How can you listen to them? And you've got to use your own common sense. People are just following blindly what other people are doing and what the government is saying, and you cannot do that anymore. Not in this.
Where have you come from, and what do you do?
Denbighdale.
We've all got a phone. We've reported the news for ourselves, so we can see the lies when the mainstream media throws the propaganda at us. The mainstream news has an obligation to find the truth and report on the truth, and they don't do that. So I'm here today to just try and bring some light onto the fact that the human trafficking thing's a problem. You know, slavery, they've created Black Lives Matter to do with slavery, while the mainstream media are hiding the real fact that slavery still exists. The people are still being sold, you know, the children are being sold, undocumented, and that's a form of slavery in my eyes.
We've come up from Worthing today and all over West Sussex. And we're here because we want to make our voices heard, because we can see very clearly that this COVID-19 so-called plandemic is actually being used as a pretext for introducing the New World Order. That might sound crazy, but when you look at the way our human rights have been stripped from us, it's not so hard to see.
Our life, our family, our decision. So why have you come along?
Well, basically, everything we know, all of our freedoms, has just been taken away. I've got a little girl. I don't wish to have her poisoned by a psychopath. The government are completely lying to us about everything. It's like they're just playing the public. They're just playing us.
What's the solution?
For everyone to wake up, basically.
I quite like that last one. I don't want my child to be poisoned by a psychopath. In a lot of the coverage of this, Martin, we had the major national newspapers saying that the whole thing was led by lunatics. There was this sort of idea that, well, this is a loony demonstration. Do you think that's fair?
Well, there's going to be different views about this. I mean, there's several different views being presented there by the people participating. So, and of course, you know, I believe Piers Corbyn was on Good Morning Britain and got a monstering from Piers Morgan and various others. You know,
okay, you say he got a monstering. Okay, so I mean, we haven't got a clip of that on here tonight, but he was abused after he'd been on air. So they didn't call him a lunatic and say he was mad to his face. They waited until he was off air, and then they said it whilst he wasn't able to reply.
Yeah, well, I think that tends to suggest that everybody's getting way too involved in this. You know, there are going to be different views about this. Of course there are. And that's inevitable. And, of course, you can scream and shout at people, whatever your views, but that's not necessarily going to get us anywhere,
is it? There is a huge range of view. I've never known a topic where there's been such a wide range, from psychopaths poisoning our children to, you know, we must, you know, to avoid the mass extermination, we must all have a vaccine within 3 months. You know, it's just extraordinary.
It is, certainly is. And that debate, of course, we need effective journalism, we need balanced journalism, and we need interrogative journalism in order to have that public discussion. Anyway, so one of the speakers, I mean, there were all sorts, but my personal favourite is Professor Dolores Cahill, who's an epidemiologist an Irish epidemiologist. She's worked all over the world, really at the top of her field, but she has really stepped aside from her main job, and she has become a very vehement campaigner, particularly around the what she believes is bad science and bad medicine, which is being peddled in the mainstream press for truth. So let's have a listen to a part of her speech last Saturday in Trafalgar Square.
This is not 100% of the annual flu death. It's not 70%. It's not 50%. The annual flu deaths are 400,000. It's not 40%. It's not 10%. It's not 5%. It's 1%. We had 1% of chance of dying of the normal flu season. There was no need to call a pandemic. It's an absolute crime. Yeah! 1%. That means they knew that there was no danger. And as Dr. Vernon Coleman has said, and Professor nation that did not give our loved ones the proper treatment. We need to change this. We are the change. We are the change. We are the change. We are the change. The second bit of good news is that there are wonderful treatments. So if you get a flu, you'll have the symptoms for a week. And there are wonderful treatments like hydroxychloroquine. Yes, that works in 3 hours. So if you have flu, hydroxychloroquine will work. You won't get symptoms, so our elderly will not be sick. And you know, with the disease, you have to have symptoms. So they are diagnosing a disease with no symptoms. And I have a world-renowned fact. If you have no symptoms, you don't need to go to hospital. If you have no symptoms and you don't need to go to hospital, you're not going to die. So stop testing. Stop testing. Stop testing. Stop testing. Stop testing. Stop testing. Stop testing.
And that contrasts with Jacinda over in New Zealand, Martin. Her mantra is test. I've got to get the accent right. Test, test, test. And now there's Dolores Cahill saying stop testing. What she's saying effectively is that the tests are bringing up not only false positives, but they're testing now for a strain of COVID, which is nowhere near as dangerous as the original strain was, which is counterproductive. It's causing lockdowns where people aren't actually even ill.
Well, I'm agnostic about all of this. That was a very emotional speech. That's what I'd say. And, I'll bet you though that in New Zealand the majority are going to return Jacinda in the election on September the 18th because they think she's done a good job, and most of them will never have heard of Dolores Cahill.
Ian, what do you make of the demonstration and particularly what Dolores has had to say?
Well, I found myself in a rather odd position here, Tony, because I've got it in three different ways. Our neighbour in Hove was the super spreader who kicked it all off in January, and I was on TV news saying how his symptoms were minimal. So that puts me down as a sceptic, I suppose.
Well, just tell us about this, because this was right at the very beginning, back in March, was
yeah.
it?
No, soon February, yeah.
February,
yeah.
Wow. Take us through that story then.
Well, to cut a long story short, we got up one morning and there was a load of people milling around outside the house. We're a quiet suburban street,
this
by the way.
This is in Brighton, isn't it?
In Hove.
In Hove.
Hove, please.
sorry.
And it turned out that our neighbour, unbeknown to us, was in intensive care. Not intensive care, in quarantine, you know, what do they call it? Anyway, in hospital with this terrible new virus, which was destined to kill lots and lots of people. And I spoke to them, you know, on the phone, and they said, this is a load of rubbish.
So at this time, just to sort of think back, we had the outbreak had started already in Wuhan, and it was being we're seeing on the news things like pictures of people actually lying in the street. It looks as if they passed out in the street, that sort of thing. But it hadn't reached this part of the world at all at that point.
No, it hadn't. No.
Apparently.
Yeah.
But it reached Hove.
But it reached Hove. Well, this was one of the first people that the record shows, the official record shows, brought it in. And I just went on, I said to the media outside, you know, because we were getting a bit fed up with them by then. They'd been there for a few days. I said, look, I've just spoken to them and it's a complete non-story. I said, it's a rubbish story. And that phrase went all over the networks. It was on the main news on TV. So I feel a bit sort of committed now. And when they started saying, well, there's 1,000 people dying a day, you know, I thought, well, blimey, you know, maybe I'm partly responsible for not raising the alarm about this. But then we found out that most of those 1,000 people are actually dying of other things and in care homes. My take on it is that there is something there. And because they've run down the National Health Service so badly, they panicked. And that's why they emptied the hospitals and filled up the care homes and indirectly killed all the people like that, was because they knew that the NHS couldn't cope with the slightest problem. Compare, for instance, Germany, where they've had a very, very low death rate. Nobody will tell you this on the BBC, or if they do, it'll be well buried. But, of course, the big difference between here and Germany is that in Germany, they've got spare capacity in the health service, like any sensible person running any organisation knows. You've got to have spare capacity for the unforeseen things. And they knew they didn't have it. It was far too late to create it. So they went into panic mode and made what could have been a minor epidemic into a huge global story, basically.
Well, one of the things that was coming out at the protests on Saturday in London was this whole idea that the virus has not been proven to exist. Now, I would take issue with that. Martin, we know, don't we, that there's potential here, quite a strong potential for this to be actually a bioweapon, a man-made COVID-19. And so, obviously, if it is, then the government will not be wishing to put the genome and all the details of it all around and about here, there and everywhere. So I wonder if people like Piers Corbyn aren't barking up the wrong tree saying, oh, well, you haven't proved us by showing this genome of this thing. Maybe it's just simply because, actually, if they did, it might be some fingerprints all over that genome showing that it is a military weapon rather than just an ordinary coronavirus, the common cold.
I thought they had. I thought the Chinese produced an alleged genome.
Well, they did, yes.
Genome.
The British government haven't, though. That's the point they were making in Trafalgar Square. Right. Anyway, Martin.
Well, one of the first things that crossed my mind, that it was some kind of a bioweapon, and of course you've got Steve Bannon, who's now under arrest in the US, and the Murdoch press definitely pushing the idea that it was a bioweapon developed by the Chinese, which had escaped from the Wuhan laboratory. And spokespeople for the Chinese government then responded by pointing out that the Wuhan Games, military games, had taken place just at the time when this was all beginning, and that allowed a vector for NATO intelligence services to bring in a bioweapon. We know that they used anthrax from Fort Detrick in the subsequent to 9/11. That definitely led back to the US.
And well, that was used, basically, wasn't it? It was sent to senators and media.
In integral part of the 9/11 yes. And of course, operation.
Yes, that's right. So we know that they do use this kind of thing. And, of course, the Chinese intelligence services probably know that too.
So who are they? Who is posting these letters?
Well, it'll be the deep state in the US, won't it? Whatever the deep state is. We can even name names if we've got enough information to name names. They were all involved. You know, they've been developing these biological and chemical weapons for years. In theory, they're not supposed to be doing it. As Craig Murray pointed out, the Russian biological and chemical warfare laboratories, which were located in Uzbekistan, were dismantled at the time he was a British ambassador there. And, of course, they fulfilled their... And, of course, Assad got rid of all the chemical weapons that he had in Syria under the supervision of the OCPCW.
Yeah, but the Chinese have said the Wuhan lab was a civilian lab. The only problem is there was Pentagon money in
there. That's right. So
that does sound a bit weird, doesn't it? What's Pentagon money doing in a Chinese civil laboratory for viruses?
What's going on is, because of MERS and SARS in the past, there is definitely, I would argue, a legitimate fear that pandemics will develop either naturally or possibly, as we're discussing, as a result of manipulation. And one of the things that these laboratories do, I understand, is that they get relatively harmless viruses and weaponize them so that they can deal with a weaponized virus or a mutated virus because they've already developed
a vaccine. Just a minute. Are you saying, I have to blink and sort of pinch myself. Are you saying that they're developing these deadly viruses that could spread and kill millions of people just in order to sort of use them as a kind of a test to see what would happen if someone was crazy enough to invent that virus?
Or by running through mutating the virus, you can see how it might mutate in the wild. This is the sort of justification, and therefore you've already worked out what might happen, and you've got virus. You've developed things to block it. Now, in actual fact,
sounds like quite a dangerous.
Well, it is indeed, and of course, in actual fact, there are laws again. You know, in theory, the international conventions are all of these things should be stopped. Now, in actual fact, the US, like in many other things, is not signed up to these international... They signed the convention, but they refused to ratify it, which is why Fort Detrick and Porton Down are still there. I mean, basically, they should be abolished. But they've not been abolished because we haven't abolished them.
Anyway, back to Saturday in the demo in London, and arrested was Piers Corbyn, who's the brother of the former Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn, who was one of the organisers, allegedly. I have to say that because he's now apparently been fined £10,000. But anyway, you mentioned that he was on the Piers Morgan show, and here he is on the Richie Allen show talking about his appearance on the Piers Morgan programme, and it starts with Richie Allen here.
Morgan and Susanna Reid are of a certain age. They remember when it used to be done properly. And when you were dropping a couple of truth bombs on them and giving them some truth about hydroxychloroquine or whatever it is, they're burning burning with shame that they're not doing it.
Couldn't cope with it. It's a fact, and they just said that's not true. But they were lying directly on the TV. And they committed, slander against me, calling me a nutter, when I was off air, but they were still there. I mean, I wonder if Piers Morgan has even got O-level physics. I don't know. But, you know, he's clearly, if he has knowledge, he doesn't like using it. He just wants to shout at people, which is completely out of order. But I think Richie, this is a sign of the times, because, you know, that and then our fund being taken down and, of course, my arrest itself. That was very interesting because, you see, in the 2 weeks building up to the Trafalgar Square 35,000 at least rally, the police had been very reasonable. I mean, I discussed things with them, talked every day, and they asked, well, okay, Mr. Corbyn, what are you really expecting? Have you got any safeguards? Is there any trouble? You know, sensible discussions in a normal way. And I said, yes, where do you want to go afterwards? We'll make sure you can march from Trafalgar Square towards Downing Street and so forth. So they were cooperative. Then, at the last minute, when most people had left the square and I was still hanging around talking to people, a different group of police turned up and just pounced on me and put me in a van. And I said, look, guys, what is going on here? Because this isn't anything in that we were expecting. And the coppers said, indicated in a not very unroundabout way, it came from the top, Mr. Corbyn. So, you know, there was a decision taken somewhere that whatever, because our rally was so successful, and therefore we'd embarrassed them so much, I don't know, that we had to be taken out. And they would have taken out more people, but for the fact that some people realised what was going on and scarpered from the square quickly.
Interesting, that, isn't it? From the top. I wonder whether what they mean by that, those police speaking as they arrested Piers Corbyn in Trafalgar Square. Do they mean Priti Patel, Home Secretary? Do they mean Sadiq Khan, the London Mayor? Or do they mean Cressida Dick, the Chief of the Met? Who's in charge?
Technically, the Met's under the control of the Home Office, I think, isn't it? Or it always used to be.
Yeah, I would imagine it might be Priti Patel.
Yeah.
But this is political arrests, isn't it, this sort of thing? And that's what he's certainly hinting at there. And a lot of the reports have said that this is an extraordinary arrest because there are all sorts of other demonstrations that have happened, some of which have been violent, where these sorts of arrests haven't taken place.
That's right. I mean, I think it's... and, of course, the £10,000 fine has only just been brought in for people who break COVID regulations. It's not like a normal, you know...
But with no court case, no trial, nothing like that?
I'll be interested to see if it does go to court. I think the defence that Jeremy Corbyn could make is that Piers Corbyn could make is that I've been talking to the police every day for the 2 weeks prior and they said it was all okay. So how can you then charge and fine me £10,000?
It's interesting, they don't seem to have to produce the evidence that he's an organiser. They're just fining him, Ian.
Just for being there.
Bizarre. Anyway, we'll see what happens. That one's obviously going to bumble along. But I suppose in a way more serious is the GoFundMe deleting the fundraising campaign for the lockdown sceptic Piers Corbyn. That's announced, I think it was Wednesday this week. People are seeing bias about which campaigns are still allowed to operate. So he mentioned briefly there that his fund has been closed down. He's put out a GoFundMe campaign to fund his campaign to win his court case or to pay his fine or whatever, Martin. They just shut it down. GoFundMe have said, nope, you're not funding that.
Well, the thing about GoFundMe is ultimately they're a private organisation, like many are, and if they want to close you down, then they can. And that's not saying that's right. I'm just saying that's within their power.
Well, I mean, the first thing that I'd note from this is that all the fears of the anti-COVID activists have been apparently, you know, completely substantiated by it. It's exactly what I would have thought could never have happened, that you could be fined £10,000 for turning up at a peaceful demonstration, basically.
Well, actually, apparently the fine is for organising. There are certain demonstrations, it seems, which are okay and some not. Anyway, we'll see what happens with this. One of the other people that commented on this or was on talk radio on Monday was Peter Hitchens.
There was a protest on Saturday, and of course at this protest there were all kinds of weirdos, and beyond doubt, and the British Union of Fascists banner, and I think David Icke
was there,
there's a loopy loo sorts, but I think there were also, as there were a similar one in Berlin, quite a large number of people genuinely perplexed by what's happening to the country. Mm. And a really astonishing thing happened afterwards, which has been very lightly reported in the newspapers today, that Piers Corbyn,
that's
Jeremy Corbyn's brother, who was the organiser, was grabbed by the police at the end of this demonstration. I mean, literally grabbed, and fined £10,000 under new laws restricting public gatherings of more than 30 people. It sounds to me like the Greek colonels. Parliament, I don't believe, has published a law allowing someone to be fined £10,000 without trial for organising a demonstration, which was, as far as I know, peaceful, and which were insulted with the police for days beforehand.
So the police said there were 38,000 people in Berlin, but he's saying here, Martin, isn't he, this is implying here that this is a bit of a slippery slope, that basic liberties are being lost. You know, the idea that you need some evidence in order to fine you seems out the window.
Well, as I understand it, the £10,000 for people organising raves, so they've extended it to demos of more than 50 people or whatever.
Yeah, I think it's any kind of gathering more than 50.
There's apparently been a cabinet meeting at which 50 people turned up this week. And the Prime Minister, they basically were all crammed in for a meeting with him. Is he going to be fined? I think we can separate out here. People have got different views about the COVID crisis. I tend to view that it's a biological warfare attack on China, but that's just me. But the fining of Piers Corbyn £10,000 for being the evil mastermind behind the demonstration clearly is an infringement of civil liberties.
Well, look, if it's a biological warfare attack on China, why have we had 41,000 people die in Britain?
Because the whole point, as I've said to you before, Tony, if you look at what happens, is in September, the repo market in the US started to collapse, and they started to intervene to bail out the banks again, as in 2008.
So is it backfired?
No, it's not backfired. Let me just get through the... I'll be as brief as I can. In November, we know from the Times of Israel and ABC News that the Israeli Defense Forces, the IDF, were given a heads up by the Defense Intelligence Agency of the United States of America that there was going to be a pandemic coming out of China. Then, of course, things start happening. Now, what I imagine may have happened here, I'm not saying this is what happened, but this is just a speculation, a copper's hunch, if you like. They're trying to take down the Chinese economy. They've had a massive swine fever, which has wiped out half of their swine herd. They then, this is all into this year, and the beginning and the end of last year, they've lost. They then had a flu epidemic and bird flu, which killed off all their chickens. And then this happens. And of course, they treated.
I have to say, actually, within the last few weeks, they've also had some outbreak of bubonic plague in China.
Indeed, and don't forget, at the same time, we've got Pompeo saying we're no longer going to tolerate China. And we've got there's this book called The Thucydides Trap, which has been written by a US academic, whose name I've forgotten, which is basically arguing that if we don't get China now, they're going to be in a position where we won't be able to get
them
in
the
future.
So this is sounding very similar to the Cold War and the missile gap, where the Americans were saying, we're going to have to get the Russians now because they're catching up with their nuclear arsenal.
Yeah, well, it's not just about nuclear. This is actually to do with the economy. Because, you know, they always were fairly snooty about this. They thought that the Japanese would never defeat
the Chinese electronics. Are building nuclear power stations like they're going out of fashion, aren't they?
Well, it's not just nuclear power, it's things like 5G and Huawei and all the rest of it.
And they're not doing that because they don't have any oil.
The point is about that. That then they would allow it to flow back over themselves. Don't forget, the deep state in the US is not necessarily friendly to Trump because they need a cover to carry on bailing the banks out. Look at Rishi Sunak here. the Tories, instead of, you know, there is a magic money tree, and they were going to spend 50 billion and they spent 250
yeah, but
billion.
The big beneficiaries, the big beneficiaries have been people like Amazon and Facebook. These seem
yes,
to be,
and also the banks people. Who should have collapsed. Because they were collapsing anyway in September.
Okay, well, anyway, Peter Hitchens...
This is what people don't get.
Peter Hitchens went on to talk about the whole idea of an economic recovery, which he was rather poo-pooing.
I saw one paper saying this would destroy the recovery, and I said, what recovery?
Right.
This is after last week, Pret a Manger, a sandwich bar, sacked thousands of people, and after, again, returning to my home city, the mini plant in Oxford began to sack people making cars. There is no recovery. There's the absolute opposite of a recovery. But I think the problem is, if these tax rises don't take place, then the other thing will happen, which is there will be no money to run the public services,
right.
Not least the NHS we're supposed to be so concerned about. So absolutely everything that people rely on will be starved of money. And if you say, well, that road hasn't been repaired, or the hospitals are slum, and the lavatories leak, and all the rest of it, people will say, well, sorry. But the cuts, the COVID cuts, which we're going to come up against, the COVID cuts mean we can't afford to fix that. We can't afford to hire the people. We can't afford to keep people employed. And we will live in a society with a much, much lower standard of living because of this. Mm. And the other thing which is going to happen, and you think you can escape it, maybe if the tax raids are postponed, is that, of course, the inflation, which I think is now absolutely bound to happen because they pumped quantitative easing into the public purse for the first time. People are getting money in their pockets from the government in the Rishi Sunak schemes. That has launched a huge amount of money into the open market rather than just the bond market or wherever it was before. And inflation will mean that whatever savings you may have, which of course includes the pension which you hope to live on in your later years, will be shriveled to nothing.
Yeah.
And only people who have assets will survive it. And this is another terrible thing, which people just, because I'm afraid economics is not even taught adequately in most of our schools to most people, will take people by horrible surprise when it comes. But it's so visible to anybody who knows what's going on.
Well, that's interesting to hear Peter Hitchens agreeing with you a little bit, Martin, that people don't get taught proper economics.
I think we've got to step in here and tell Peter Hitchens that there is a magic money tree, and he's completely wrong about that. And much as I respect Peter Hitchens on a lot of issues, he's 100% wrong about that.
Well, just explain then.
Well,
he's talking about inflation.
Inflation was something that happened in the 1970s and early 80s, and hasn't really happened anywhere since. And it was dealt with by Thatcherite supply-side economics. Basically, if you've got an economy that's running at capacity, the global economy running at capacity, and then you start throwing extra cash into it, yes, you will get inflation. But that's not where we are. We're in a huge oversupply. The problem is that nobody's got the money to buy all the things that are pouring out of China, America, if Trump gets his way, Europe, everywhere. So that is the problem. And yes, it can be solved by the best thing to do is to print the money, but the best people to give it to are the poor, of course,
Martin,
not the banks.
Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I broadly would agree with that. I think Peter Hitchens has got the wrong, and there's far more deflationary pressure in the system than he imagines. But of course, the real problem is we've got a total disconnect between the stock markets, which are at the highest levels they've ever been, and the actual figures for the real economy, which is about to fall down the drain. Now, that just shows you how completely separate these two things are. What they've done is they've bailed the banks out again, so there's a whole, that will crash at some point, but there's a load of money to be made by that. I mean, as we can see, the hedge fund people are making a packet out of this latest bubble. But at the same time, of course, ordinary people are saving rather than spending because they're worried about their future, which of course drags demand out of the economy. And asset prices are rising, which of course is a problem for ordinary people because it means they can't afford anywhere to live and they can't afford the rent and things like this. And ultimately, this is going to end in tears quite obviously. And but there's no reason to start cutting public expenditure now. In the long run, you may have to try and balance the books, but the way to do that is to take the money off the people who've been making out like bandits. That's the only way to do it, and of course they're going to resist that.
And Sunak is talking, to be fair, he is talking about a wealth tax.
Yes, I mean, Rishi Sunak has floated that, to his own party.
And actually,
and of course, it went down like a lead balloon. What are you talking about?
Well, to be fair to Peter Hitchens, he's also saying there's going to have to be a wealth tax.
Well, I mean, that's quite logical. I mean, but the point is that we shouldn't have to worry about that now. The wealth tax will come. I mean, if there was a Labour government, imagine if McDonnell was the Chancellor, he would be flagging up, yes, there's going to have to be a wealth tax, especially since you've just made such a lot of money out of this crisis. And you could have one-off profits tax.
But how ironic that, you know, the Labour right, who've now seem to be firmly in control of the party again, you know, that they wouldn't dare suggest a wealth tax because they'd fear being labelled as left-wing.
Well, I mean, what's happened with Rishi Sunak is he's been captured by the Treasury and he's come out with some sensible proposal.
Isn't the Treasury really the city, Martin?
No, not entirely.
I think it is.
No,
I
not entirely, the Tony. The city isn't in favour of wealth taxes, Tony. The Bank of England, the Treasury are a different thing. I mean, of course, there's a revolving door and so on, but of course, we do have a permanent civil service here, so some people actually spend their whole lives on that side of events.
Okay, so at the very least, the city have got their spies in every single corridor in the Treasury, haven't they?
Yes, well,
they know what they're going to do weeks or months before the Treasury do it.
Well, I mean, and of course, in other countries, and even to some extent here, there's a revolving door, so in actual fact, they end up being the same. But I mean, the point is that, Sunak suggesting that it would have to be some kind of wealth taxes is welcome. But of course, you saw that this is what the meeting was between the Prime Minister and his backbenchers, where they were not socially distanced, they were all crammed in at the back, because he was basically promising them there would be no wealth taxes. So they all left with a sigh of relief to go home and die of COVID.
So those wealth taxes are really not taxing the money that's being made by those investments in the stock exchange, which is being artificially pumped up with all this QE. Okay, so we've learned, haven't we, that by printing money you don't necessarily cause inflation, and actually that really what we need is something like Richard Murphy and John McDonnell's QE for the people.
Yeah.
As you first of all said there, actually, Ian, that this QE money needs to go to the poorer people. Not only do they need it to buy the basic goods, to pay
the
rent, etc., they will spend it and they'll actually get the economy moving.
And if you give money to the rich, they'll spend it on assets and create asset inflation.
Okay, so the Conservatives are really doing the complete opposite of what needs to happen.
Well, apart from the fact that they did decide that we're about to end furlough in this country next month, but of course in Germany they're going to carry on with their version of it, which they've used before. It's a standard procedure that they use in recessions. That's going to go on indefinitely, and in France they're talking about keeping it going for the next 2 years. But Rishi Sunak has definitely bet his he's bet on the fact that everybody thinks he's great now because he's in favour of wealth taxes. He's given everybody free dinners. And he's basically spent a hell of a lot more money than he said he was going to spend at the beginning of the crisis. All of which is good, but he's now going to turn around and be the punishing parent and take it all away. And of course, what that will do is it'll put the economy in a tailspin, just about ready to leave the EU with no deal
in
January.
So, at least on that one, you and Peter Hitchens are aligned. He says there's not going to be a recovery.
No, there isn't going to be a recovery until we've completely changed the policy. We need a complete change of policies at the top, and we need a policy which is actually geared towards ordinary people's needs and the environment. But we're a long way from that.
So, from the London demonstration on Saturday with about 35,000 people, or 30,000 people certainly, with Trafalgar Square crammed, to Bristol with about 250 of us in Castle Park, all socially distanced, very obedient, and some terrific speeches, not by me particularly, but by, I did a little talk, I think it was for about 10-15 minutes at the start, which you can find on YouTube, but Judith Brown turned up and she did what I thought was a fascinating little talk. She's former nurse, she's a PhD doctor, not a medical doctor, but she was making a very, very simple point that for people must look up. I mean, she's basically done the research herself. If you have a flu jab, you're more likely to die of COVID. So have a think before you have that flu jab. I thought that was a point very well made, and she made it. But the highlight for me was actually not any of the speakers. It was this lady that turned up, not sure what her name is. If you know who she is, do tell me. You can find my contact details at thisweek.org.uk on the contact page there, because I thought she did rather a lovely poem.
I just thought it all was a bit fishy, because we were given all sorts of statistics about corona public health,
but nothing about strokes, heart attacks, suicide, any other kind of illness that was going to be worse because of the lockdown. So I looked into it and I kept on coming across a certain name, Bill Gates. And I've written this, it's a song really, but I'm going to chant it. And it's called Bill Gates is Not the Messiah. Bill Gates is not the Messiah. He's a very naughty boy. And he'll double his wealth now Global Health is his chief executive toy. He poured his tax-free dollars into a high-return vaccine, and he wants to stick just a tiny prick into every human being. Gates is not the Messiah, though he sure can mesmerize with a tax-free gag to a back-free rag and assisted Google AIs. He brings the truth and the good news and fake checks all the rest. With a youthful ball, he'll divide and rule. If you sneeze, you might be blessed. Gates is not the Messiah, though he'll feed the multitude with a GM crop that'll grow then stop till the contract is renewed. The earth will be deweeded of biodiversity, and to get your food, you've got to be tattooed with a biometric ID. Hey! Gates is not the Messiah, though he wants the common good. If we copulate, we'll overpopulate. There'll be unplanned parenthood. So if, in spite of gaming, you might have scored a duck, get your vax passport, thank the Lord, go for. But for Gates' sake, don't go fuck! Gates is not the Messiah, though he has risen aloft. Can a billionaire really that much care if his heart is Microsoft? He went from riches to riches with a talent to invest, from proprietary DOS to the high DevOps in pursuit of his interest. Hey! This is the last verse. How is it so far? Though we are to him as sheep. Satellites will view everything we do, even though we are asleep. I don't believe he's evil. Maybe he means well, but our souls aren't safe. His intentions pave the way to Orwellian hell!
Well,
thank you so much for that.
Well, that's a mystery lady that turned up the bandstand in Castle Park here in Bristol about 2:30 on Sunday as part of that, I think it's called Stand Up Bristol demonstration, which was very kindly invited along to speak at. These sorts of things are happening, Martin, as well as the Black Lives Matter demonstrations going on. We've also got Extinction Rebellion been demonstrating this week, plus I think a smaller group called Antifa. There does seem to be a sort of almost, is this a, you know, take your pick now. There's quite a few movements out there that are kicking back against the establishment or the authorities.
Yeah, there's a lot. I mean, obviously, there's a great deal of discontent from different angles. Also, of course, there's a great deal of manipulation of that discontent by various forces. Very dangerous times all round. The economy, the world economy, is on a knife edge. There is going to be some kind of crash. And when it happens, of course, the resources of the state will all have been spent on bailing the banks out. So you're going to have real struggles over resources going forward.
Well, you'll be happy to hear that Vernon Coleman is not doing any more of his, Dr. Vernon Coleman, any more of his YouTube videos, because you don't like the chap. But, I mean, I'm a big fan of him from years ago. Probably from, it was the 1990s I first came across him, when he authored a book called How to Stop Your Doctor Killing You. And actually, it wasn't really aimed at doctors. It was aimed at the pharmaceutical industry. I wonder what you make, Ian, of the pharmaceutical lobby
lobby, because it seems to have grown immensely in power. Certainly, you know, certainly since we were youngsters.
Well, it's follow the money, isn't it? You know, I mean, there's something to be said, I think, about the COVID issue, is that there is now a COVID industry, you know, and there's a lot of people are doing quite well out of COVID. You know, not, for instance, the credit card companies. If you spend £2 now in a corner shop or a cafe, they'll want a card, and they're paying a surprising amount if they're a small place that can't do a good deal with the credit card companies. So that's one, you know, people. Obviously, the pharmaceutical industry, one mustn't jump to conclusions, but it seems very odd that hydrochloroquine is being systematically denigrated as a potential remedy for coronavirus when it happens to be very cheap.
Yes, in fact, it's out of patent, isn't it?
Yeah.
This is the point.
It would be a disaster for the pharmaceutical industry.
The thing I find so annoying about this, we've got no mainstream press coverage of this at all, is that the virus was called SARS-CoV-2 when it first was discovered in China. That was the first designation it was given. So it was quite clear. They were saying that this is a SARS type of coronavirus. SARS is well known. It's actually been out there for quite a while. And chloroquine is the prescribed medicine for SARS. So why on earth would various health authorities around the world issue edicts saying we don't want you doctors prescribing chloroquine for this COVID-19?
Well, what about the fake article in The Lancet? I mean, that's absolutely appalling, and it hasn't even been commented on that I've seen. A completely false article appeared in The Lancet, which is one of the planet's leading and very respected. I always respected The Lancet as being truthful. They came up, for instance, with the figures about how many people had been killed in Iraq, which were very embarrassing to the establishment. Well, they produced this article saying, oh, hydrochloroquine is harmless and possibly dangerous, ineffective and possibly dangerous. And instantly, like almost overnight, several tests, screening programs and, you know, trials were abandoned. Within a week, and that's the really extraordinary thing, within a week, The Lancet had withdrawn the article, the alleged authors, some of them had taken their names off it, and it was basically a 100% fraudulent article, which had the effect of almost completely killing hydrochloroquine in the West as being a cure. Although, of course, in India, it seems to be playing quite an important part in limiting the pandemic.
I think it seems certainly various studies are saying between anything up from 30% of lives have been being saved by use of chloroquine. That's the figures I've seen. And it seems, you know, maybe this is just simply being suppressed because the agenda here is to come up with a vaccine which is going to be much more expensive and turn the vaccine industry, the big pharmaceutical companies that are producing this, as I think it's Del Bigtree pointed out, that this could go from $1 billion industry, or I think it's at $500 billion industry, to $1 trillion industry. So it could actually go up an entire step in how much money is being made out of vaccines. So let's see what happens with that. But our politicians are supposed to be sorting all this sort of thing out. They haven't really been doing much of a good job. I think most of them seem to be bought by the big pharma's lobby, just as they were in many of these wars by the war lobby. So let's have a listen now to Prime Minister's questions. They're back this Wednesday, Keir Starmer and Boris Johnson having a little bit of a spat again.
Keir Starmer.
The Prime Minister is just tin-eared and making it up as he goes along. Yeah. I'm surprised. The Education Secretary stood at that dispatch box yesterday and said and acknowledged that Labour's first priority has been getting children back to school. That's been our first priority. I've said it numerous times in this dispatch box. He knows it very well. He's just playing games. Mr. Speaker, and he's fooling nobody. Even his own MPs have run out of patience. The Vice-Chair of the 22 Committee, the MP for Broxbourne, has said the government says one thing on Monday, changes its mind on Tuesday, something different is presented on Wednesday. That sounds familiar, doesn't it? Another of MPs, who wisely wants to remain anonymous, perhaps in the chamber today, he or she said, I am speaking for you because this is what was said, it's mess after mess, his own MPs, U-turn after U-turn. It's a fundamental issue of competence. God knows what's going on. There's no grip. His own MPs are right, aren't they?
Mr. Speaker, this is a leader of the opposition who backed remaining in the EU and now is totally silent on the phone, now has performed a U-turn. He backed, and perhaps he still does, Mr. Speaker. This is a leader of the opposition who supported an IRA condoning politician who wanted to get out of NATO and now says absolutely nothing. This is a leader of the opposition who sat on the front bench whilst there was anti-Semitism.
I think there are questions being asked. We do need to try and answer the questions that's being put to the Prime Minister. It will be helpful to those who are watching to know the answers, Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I think it will be helpful to all those who are watching to know.
Minister, I think I'll make the decisions today. Come on, Prime Minister.
Sorry, Mr. Speaker, if I may say, I think it will be helpful to all those who are watching to know that this opposition and this leader of the opposition said absolutely nothing to oppose the method of examinations that was proposed, and indeed they opposed the teacher accreditation system that we eventually came up with. Is he now saying that those grades aren't right, or is it just Captain Hindsight leaping on a bandwagon and opposing a policy that he supported 2 weeks ago?
Mr. Starmer.
The problem is he's governing in hindsight. That's why he's making so many mistakes. Mr. Speaker, before I go on, the Prime Minister said something about the IRA, and I want him to take it back. I worked in Northern Ireland for 5 years with the police service of Northern Ireland, bringing peace. I prosecuted the Director of Public Prosecution, serious terrorist, for 5 years, working with the intelligence and security forces and with the police in Northern Ireland. Asked the Prime Minister to have the decency to withdraw that comment.
Well, I would just point out that Boris Johnson wasn't actually talking about Keir Starmer supporting the IRA. He was saying that he supported Jeremy Corbyn, who supported the IRA. So he didn't withdraw the comment. But, Martin, it all seems to be getting very personal, doesn't it? When I listen to Prime Minister's questions, I like to hear a few facts, and I like to hear, you know, people being challenged on the facts, not on, you know, these sort of almost like schoolboy knockabout stuff. It seems to have gone back to that again.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the problem. I've never been a fan of Prime Minister's questions, for example.
But the thing is, with Jeremy Corbyn, he seemed to be concentrating on hitting the Prime Minister with statistics, facts, and an actual, you know, genuine information, whereas this seems to be much more innuendo now.
Well, I mean, he's basically pointing out the fact that the government has U-turned several times over the exams fiasco. It's a perfectly legitimate thing to point out, and of course, Boris Johnson, who wasn't paying much attention, has got to take responsibility for it. He dumped it all on Gavin Williams.
Ian, what do you make of these two opponents, and how well is the opposition doing and the government?
Well, I was just, you know, thinking while you were talking about that, how depressed, it's a little bit depressing that the public don't see. I mean, it was quite obvious that Johnson didn't have an answer. So what he did was he came up with a standard load of smears. He couldn't even remember it accurately. Maybe he is, you know, a lot of people are thinking that maybe he did get quite ill with the COVID and he hasn't really fully recovered. But he certainly couldn't speak very well, I didn't think. And all he could do was to come up with a standard bunch of smears. That's not answering the question. And you'd think that people would think, well, obviously, if he can't say anything any better than that, he's rubbish. But sadly, people seem to join in. You know, if they start a sort of witch hunt and start pointing and screaming about things, then, you know, some people get taken
I wonder, is this an accident that these sorts of people get into these positions, or is it deliberate? Is the whole democratic system being discredited? Because, of course, this benefits the private industry.
I just worry about human nature, you know. I think we tend to rally around, the leaders. It's there in our genes. And if we don't recognise this and build it into the legal system to stop it happening, and I've got a project, you know, that would point the way forward, I hope, on that, which I can tell you about later.
Well, say something about it now.
Well, I've just got a sort of trial website called accountabledemocracy.org.uk, and the idea is, how could we get to a sane society from the society we're in without bloodshed and revolution, you know, because that's always the problem. And, you know, I've got a few ideas that I'm developing, which I'm hoping might influence
people. Is that bloodshed and revolution inevitable at the moment, do you think? Some sort of, you know, clash between the populace and the establishment?
Well, I don't know about inevitable, but it's certainly on the cards. And those sort of revolutions don't usually end up very happily either.
Okay, so how can we do something about that? What are you proposing?
We've got to do it through normal legal procedures. The big weakness of the elite is that they're illegal, they're criminal, and it's only by staving off the forces of the law that they survive in position. And so, I mean, one of the reasons why Trump is so hated is because the crowd who pulled off 9/11 in the States, or who seem to have pulled it off, let's say, John Brennan from the CIA, for instance, who was one of the leading anti-Trump campaigners, he was the CIA station chief in Riyadh in Saudi Arabia at the time that the 9/11 plot was being hatched. I think these guys are more vulnerable than people realize to just the forces of law.
Martin, these people are above the law, many of them, aren't they? I mean, certainly the City of London, we've seen that time and again, the LIBOR scandal, Forex scandal, I mean, scandal after scandal, really, they smile, they take another bonus, and the whole thing carries on.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, I think that's absolutely right that they are criminal, and that's not just political rhetoric. When we say they are criminal, we mean that they have Interpol files. That's absolutely true. But whether that anything can be done about that, because, of course, the police officers around the world at senior level are well aware of the criminal behaviour at the top. But of course, there's limits to what they can and can't do.
But aren't they being paid off, those police?
Well, they are. I mean, Sir John Stevens, for example, was made a lord. But basically, he was saying, we're going to have to prosecute Brigadier Gordon Kerr for running the Loyalist Terror Campaign in Northern Ireland. Since we're mentioning Northern Ireland, as the Prime Minister sought to bring it up about who's protecting who. And, of course, he wasn't prosecuted. He's never been prosecuted. The last I heard of him, he was inside something called a joint services group in the green zone in Iraq, being paid by the British taxpayer. But he should have been made to stand trial in this country. And, of course, he should have been convicted and probably sent to prison for 25 years, like many IRA people were. And then he should have been allowed to go free because we've got a deal.
Well, I mean, if the criminal justice system won't arrest these people who you say are criminals, isn't there room for a citizen's arrest if they've got evidence against them?
Well, the IRA said there's room for us to go around to his house and blow his head off.
Ian.
I think I'm going to ignore that last comment, Martin.
No, the war was on, and it's now
Martin,
over.
Martin, it's just let Ian speak.
Yeah. What was the question? Sorry, Tony.
It's just about a citizen's arrest. Is this a feasible thing to do? If you've got evidence on people?
I think you've got to capture... The way they do it is they have the man at the top or the woman at the top. And most of the... If you then add on the doctrine of necessity, so that basically what they'll say is, if you could speak to them privately, they'd say, well, the reason we didn't go for this Kerr guy is because it would demoralise all the rest of the army who are busy doing equally horrible things, and so by necessity, and then we might get invaded by the Russians.
Do you think that's right, Martin?
I think that's right. Yeah, but that's the whole point of putting him on trial, is to deter them from doing exactly that.
Yes.
I mean, I look forward to the day when the senior intelligence officers and military in the US who did 9/11 are put on trial.
Well, meanwhile, we've got people like Julian Assange going through a court process, and we've also got contempt of court trial against Craig Murray, who's been supporting him up in Scotland. So it seems as if something's gone very wrong with the criminal justice system and the justice system generally.
Well, Scotland, you know, I'm sorry to say, much as I think, you know, in many ways it'd be quite good if Scotland were to detach itself from England, you know, corruption is not going to benefit. You know, I mean, Scotland, the Scottish Labour Party is, you know, a notoriously corrupt institution.
Nearly dead.
Nearly dead as a result. So there is some justice in the world. But, you know, we had a case with the 9/11 truth movement of somebody who died suspiciously in Scotland, and we found a solicitor who wanted to prosecute it, and suddenly the word came back, no, forget it, go away. You know, obviously nobbled, unfortunately. Yeah. So I think you've got to get... It's only when somebody... But it has happened. I mean, for instance, Gorbachev in the Soviet Union, he quietly rose to the top, kept his powder dry, and then once he did have that absolute power, which modern leaders do tend to have, he used it. Now, the results were unfortunate and didn't work out that well. But, you know, you can dismantle these police states But you've got
all
to be at the top.
All you need is a bit of help from the Trilateral Commission, David Rockefeller Foundation, and then you can be Gorbachev. Or actually, isn't it Starmer is a Trilateral guy?
Well, he is. Yes, Gorbachev didn't prosecute anybody from the past.
No,
he changed the system.
He changed the system,
and the history will be very kind to him. I think he was very naive about who he was dealing with. His
we don't hear a lot from him now, Martin, do we?
Well, he's still alive.
He's around.
And in actual fact, he's supporting the Russian government on most issues these days. And of course, I look forward. I'm of a generation that I'd like to see Jimmy Carter and Gorbachev commenting on current affairs.
Absolutely.
Well,
the BBC.
They were decent guys.
I'm afraid the BBC won't really be doing that. And they came up at Prime Minister's Questions this week. Unfortunately, they're just not interested in these issues. They seem to be bogged down somehow. But anyway, and what it's doing is I'm reminded a little bit about British Rail. British Rail, before it was privatised, we went into a sort of 3 or 4 or 5 year sort of spiral of it finding really difficult to actually get trains. The ticket offices weren't properly staffed. The trains often didn't turn up. The BBC seems to be in this pre-privatisation mode at the moment.
Well, the new guy's just come in. He's saying that we're going to have a more Brexit-friendly output. We need more right-wing comedians. People saying, but there aren't any right-wing comedians. You know.
Well, there are.
Not
there are
all sorts.
Apart from in the cabinet.
I think the best comedians aren't left-wing or right-wing. They just take the mickey out of both of them.
The various people are saying, well, the problem with one guy was saying about it, who's a comedian currently on the BBC, I don't necessarily
know. Do they have
that,
comedy on the BBC?
Well, they do, apparently.
This is news
and
to
he's
me.
Saying the real problem is we can't find anybody that's right-wing that's actually good enough to be on.
That's why they put all these unfunny left-wing comedians on, isn't
well,
it?
Well, I mean, I think the fact of the matter is that
Mark Thomas doesn't get a look in.
No, he doesn't. In other words, he's definitely not going to get a look in under the new setup.
In fact, even Rory Bremner.
Bring back Bernard Manning, that's what
even
I say.
Even Rory Bremner seems to be booted out of broadcasting.
Has been for ages.
Yeah.
Well, do you know, he was at their credit.
He's Channel 4, though.
Newsnight interviewed Rory Bremner, Newsnight. And they basically said, well, why aren't you on any longer? And he said, well, they won't let me on. He said, they did invite me on, but to do a travel programme.
So this starts, okay, so we're getting into now a fascinating area, which is the BBC and the other main broadcasters just trying to ban comedy. It's a bit like the Puritans. Yeah. It's a bit like the Civil War.
Well, banning Cromwell. It's banning certain kinds of comedy. So
well, there
words,
isn't any comedy, Martin. Okay, we have to agree to disagree on this. I haven't seen anything really good comedian. All of the good stuff, in fact, Charlie Skelton and his programme, Friday Night Live that he used to do, all that's been banned. Everything's gone. The idea, I think, is to demoralise the nation. Just don't give them anything to smile and laugh about anymore.
Well, I don't think it's a war on comedy. It's a war on certain kinds of ideas. Rory Bremner's stuff in the run-up to the Iraq War was forensic. Absolutely forensic.
Okay,
and
so
very detailed.
Anyway, let's have a listen to Prime Minister's questions on the BBC now.
Andrew Lloyd.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. When I buy a copy of The Mirror, The Mail or The Telegraph, I'm not required to buy a copy of The Guardian. And yet when I want to watch live TV on Sky, Amazon Prime or ITV, I am forced to pay for the BBC. Does the Prime Minister believe that this is a sustainable situation in the medium or longer term?
My honourable friend makes a very interesting point, the point of view that I'm sure is shared by many people in this country, but my right honourable friend, the Secretary of State for Culture, Media and Sport, will be setting out a roadmap shortly for reform of the BBC and addressing the very issue that he mentions.
So no real answer there. Again, I think maybe you're right about Boris. You know, he just doesn't seem to want to answer the questions. But the point is really important about the BBC. Is it valued, Ian? Do you think we should keep it or not?
Difficult question, isn't it? Because there's so much rubbish and they do so much laundering, you know, of official stories. But then on the other hand, if you look really hard, there was always that joke, wasn't there, about the New York Times? They said that the most interesting thing about the New York Times is what page the front page story is going to be. Because, you know, they do tell the truth.
They bury it.
But they bury it.
Yeah.
And there's been a couple of very interesting stories about COVID on the BBC website lately. One of them suggesting that in India, the reason they've had such a low death rate might be because everybody lives on top of each other and they all get flu. They don't have flu jabs. They all get colds and flu, and that gives them more resistance.
Yeah.
And another article telling us how some researchers have found that there are T cells, which some people have, which who haven't had had COVID, but do give you a certain amount of immunity to it. So it could be that, you know, we're getting the truth there. On the other hand, you know, they'll routinely make statements which are untrue.
Martin, there's a big difference, though, isn't there, between your sort of network BBC in London and the main, you know, the main networks, which are national, and regional BBCs, quite a different kettle of fish.
Yeah, well, I think the fundamental question here is that should there be an obligation on certain media outlets for to be not so much unbiased as to present a spectrum of views? Because in actual fact, as we know, freedom of speech means you can say whatever you like. Here we are online at the minute, and we can say pretty much what we like. Whereas, of course, if we were being broadcast by BCFM, you can be...
Well, I would have had to bleep one of the words in our poem we just had from Castle Park, for example.
Indeed, and of course, you know, so the question is, are we just going to have a free-for-all where everybody just says what they want, like that Tory MP saying, why should I pay for the BBC when I don't agree with this, some of the political opinions on it? And the answer is that as things stand, broadcast media like that are supposed to show impartiality across their output. And that applies both to the BBC, to RT, to Bristol Community Radio, to Press TV, supposedly, and they broke it, and that's why they're not allowed to be on the platform. Now, what the Tories are planning to do here is, I mean, the guy they put in is very clearly, they're going to...
This is Tim Davey,
yeah, they're going to discipline the BBC, because a lot of right-wingers think that the BBC is left-wing. I'm left-wing, and as far as I'm concerned, the BBC is right-wing. but, I mean, that's not the point, is it? The point is, are we going to have a system of broadcast where they're supposed to be impartial, or we're going to get rid of that? In which case, I can call for the assassination of the Prime Minister, and there should be no comeback.
I was going to say, I mean, it's actually about impartiality, really. I think that's what you need. You need to have both sides, and if the BBC aren't going to do that, then there should be some form of accountability.
But Murdoch wants to bring in an alternative to the BBC, which will be a Daily Mail BBC. That is his plan.
But it seems to be being sabotaged to me. That's what I'm saying. As an ex-BBC person myself...
Oh, the BBC is being sabotaged,
it's
absolutely.
It's inside and out. So you've got editors and managers who are destroying it. I mean, we heard last week from Steve Brody, former Home Affairs correspondent here at Points West and the BBC South West Region, that what you've got is you've got all these managers who never appear on air. They don't do any kind of work actually for the public on air. But they're being paid astronomical amounts. So you were to sack one or two of those. In fact, if you were to sack them all and replace them with people who were on air, you'd have something like 400 staff in the regions that are now at the moment under threat of redundancy. So, and that's for, I think it was from memory last week, it was 35 or 37 top executives being paid between £100,000 and £350,000.
It's an extraordinary number that I know that the Evening Standard did a survey into
So these people are effectively, these top managers are sabotaging the corporation.
Yes, and if Murdoch's TV station comes ahead, they'll go and work for that TV station. They'll be paid double the money.
If they were all sacked,
because it's private sector, and therefore it doesn't matter.
If they were all sacked, the whole world could breathe a sigh of relief. But anyway, more from Prime Minister's questions now. And the schools are back, and HS2 has started.
My right honourable friend will be well aware that, welcome though it is, the start of the new term this week will be challenging for all schools. It will be particularly so for Burton Green Church of England Academy in my constituency, where HS2 has just closed the road that many parents use to access the school. It's done that for several months with little notice or consultation, and contrary to assurances given during the passage of the HS2 bill. This is not, as my right honourable friend well knows, the first or only example of high-handedness or poor communication on the part of HS2. So will he please help me to require of HS2 that it does better for the people of Burton Green and elsewhere on the route?
Yeah. Prime Minister?
Yes, Mr. Speaker. Well, I heartily endorse, I'm afraid, the sentiments that he's expressed. Anybody who's worked with HS2 over the last few years will know that they do treat local residents with, I'm afraid, a high-handed approach, or have done. And what I can tell him, however, is that where there is damage to local roads, HS2 will pay compensation. I will certainly take his point up with HS2.
Can I have comments, Martin, from you first, maybe about the schools, and then both of you about HS2? I mean, you're actually back at school now, or what?
I imagine I'll be going back in next week. I've been talking to my direct employers about that.
Okay. Schools generally, well, what about HS2? Is this good value for money?
I don't think so. I mean, really, it's a big white elephant style project. What they should be doing is rebuilding the beaching railways in the peripheral parts of Britain. Rather, you see, the problem with putting lines that lead to London is that instead of taking demand out of London and putting it in Birmingham and Leeds and Manchester, you basically mean that everything flows back to London. So what you need is connectivity between Leeds and Manchester rather than Leeds.
Well,
and
one
London.
Of the peculiar things about Extinction Rebellion is they seem to be quite anti-trains, bizarrely. Although I would have thought this was the best place for people to go if they're not going to go on a car, as a tram or a train,
Well, that doesn't mean HS2.
No. What do you make of HS2, Ian?
Well, I don't have too many opinions. I had noticed Martin's point, which is that it's more likely to suck money into London than to draw it out of London. That seems fairly clear.
I mean, it's going to be a little bit quicker. I think it's sort of 20 minutes quicker getting from Birmingham to London.
It's hardly worth it, is it?
It does seem an awful lot of money to pay just to save 20 minutes off a train journey.
Well, we had Manfred Petrisch on this show, must have been, 2 years ago now, from All Smoke and Mirrors blog. When I explained to him that it was going to be around about £111 billion it was going to cost for these railway lines. He was a Swiss financier, and he used to finance railways. He did sort of 30 years in Switzerland financing all sorts of things, including railways, and he just laughed like a drain. He said, for that, you could build a railway around the world.
Well, you could write off Britain's budget deficit, practically.
Thank goodness for the magic money tree, that's all I can say.
Okay, also, lots of dinghies coming across the channel this week.
Lee Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Our nation has a proud history as a safe haven for desperate souls. But now, the asylum system is broken and being abused. So, the people of Ashfield would like to know, when will the Prime Minister introduce legislation to fix the asylum system, which will save lives by taking back control of our borders?
Prime Minister.
I thank my honourable friend, and I have a great deal of sympathy with those who are so desperate as to put their children in dinghies or even children's paddling pools and try to cross the channel. But I have to say that what they are doing is falling prey to criminal gangs, and they are breaking the law. They're also undermining the legitimate claims of others who would seek asylum in this country. And that is why we will take advantage of leaving the EU by changing the Dublin regulations on returns. And we will address the rigidities in our laws that make this country, I'm afraid, a target and a magnet for those who would exploit vulnerable people in this way.
So, Boris Johnson, not really committing to very much, just saying basically it's against the law. I mean, you, down in Brighton, do you come across any of this down in that part of the world, of the channel crossers, and what do you make of it all?
Well, what strikes me is how few people, I mean, you know, on the Mediterranean countries, following the overthrow of Colonel Gaddafi by Britain and France primarily, what he predicted has happened, and there is now a route from sub-Saharan Africa all the way through to London and Frankfurt. I mean, my friends in Germany, in Heidelberg, they tell me that most of the asylum seekers in Germany, that they're not Syrians. According to the media, they're Syrians, but they're not. They're sub-Saharan Africans who've come in through the Libya route. And so, you know, seeing as we started the war and we destroyed Libya, it seems a bit rich to moan about people making money out of the refugees that are trying to escape from there.
Martin, we're talking about 400 plus migrants in one day this week, roughly 1,500 crossing the channel in a month.
Well, I mean, there's lots of people on the move all over the world, and I'd just like to reiterate what Ian said there about the destruction of Libya.
Would you encourage these people to come to Britain?
No, I wouldn't necessarily encourage them to come to Britain. I wouldn't necessarily. What we really need to do is to change the whole global setup. So, for example, day in, day out, billions of pounds comes into the city of London from the countries they're fleeing from.
Well, hang on, because this is actually...
And they're following that money.
This is actually the mafia that they're coming, they're bringing them over. They're making a lot of money. They're making money out of every successful migrant that comes across.
That's true, but the Mafia are making money out of it because we knocked down Colonel. What Colonel Gaddafi was doing in Libya was he was actually providing work for people from sub-Saharan Africa. They were expanding the economy there, and they said, "Come here as legitimate migrants, and we will put you to work." That's all been smashed.
I think the Mafia is a bit of a red herring. They're like the sort of parasites, aren't they? That lands on
the
wounds.
They have very good linkages into the highest levels of all of this.
But Germany's taken a million, I think. And what about Syria during the Iraq invasion and the mayhem that we caused there? Syria took, I think, literally millions of Iraqis fled to Syria.
Right.
You know, we are one of the meanest, most selfish countries. When I'm sorry to say this, you know, when it comes to this sort of issue,
most refugees are refugees within their own countries. There's been 7.5 million people displaced in Colombia by the US-backed government. Then the most people after that are the people who just got crossed one border from, for example, Iraq into Syria.
I mean,
these are from the very poor countries. So around Somalia, Kenya's taken most of the.
Martin, this was going on for years and years on the border of Mexico. I think, is it San Isidro and San Diego down there between there and is it California?
Yes.
At the bottom. This has been going on for years and years. It's well known. The big companies in the United States have been lobbying for this. They've been shoveling money to the Mafia to bring them lots of cheap labour. That seems to be now happening in Europe.
No, it's not.
Across
it's
the
not
Mediterranean
just a question of cheap,
and across the Channel.
You've got to distinguish between the different. There's lots of different people who are moving for different reasons. Some people are running away from wars. Some people are running away from political persecution. Some people are running away from economic catastrophe. Yeah,
these
but they're all
migrants.
Mixed up.
Most of these people are economic migrants.
They're looking for a better life.
No one's blaming them for looking for a better life, but that's what they're doing.
They're also running away from situations which are intolerable where they come from. Most countries in Africa have been looted since the 1980s completely. All basic development has stopped in the developing world since the Reagan-Thatcher revolution. What we should have been doing all along is allowing countries to pursue economic policies which are good for their own people,
actually,
so that they can stay where they are and build a life there.
What we've done is, in these old colonial parts of the world, we've created a hostile environment for ordinary people, and they're just desperate to get out get to somewhere where they can make a living.
That's right. And it's not just make a living, it's survive in many cases. There is the legal position is that all countries have to accept asylum seekers who are genuinely fleeing from persecution or war. Now, in actual fact, a lot of these people are fleeing from war zones. And I tell you, if you were watching the Serbian army come over the hill to kill your children, you would pick up your children and you would run. And you would run in the direction of anywhere you could go. And that's what happens. And that was in Yugoslavia, but it's the same going on in Sudan, Somalia, all these other countries where the West has intervened. In Iraq, we've killed 1 million people and devastated the country.
I would dispute that the majority of these people are fleeing from war zones. I think they're just fleeing from poverty.
No, it's not true, Tony. The Eritreans, who make up a big...
Well,
big,
I think
big
what you're saying is not true, yes?
Well,
let's just have a difference of opinion,
all right,
please.
Well, I think a lot of them are actually fleeing from war zones, Tony.
And I think a lot of them are fleeing from poverty. Anyway, Ian, let you have the final
poverty can be often, you know, caused or made a lot worse by war.
Yeah,
there is a small element,
Libya,
I think, who are just basically, you know, yes, they're economic migrants, but then they've just been watching American TV programs and they want two houses and four cars.
Anyway, look, let's wind up the Prime Minister's questions look at this week by looking at the small businesses that are finding it impossible to get Rishi Sunak's wonderful loans.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Bounce Back Loan Scheme has been a huge success, delivered by the Prime Minister and indeed the Chancellor. 1.3 million loans being granted, vital support for SMEs. But the All-Party Group on Fair Business Banking, which I co-chair, has established there are 250,000 businesses who currently bank with fintechs and alternative lenders who do not have access to those loans because they cannot get access to the Bank of England's term funding scheme. And lenders who do have those loans are not really accepting loan applications from new customers. Would the Prime Minister use his best offices to persuade the Governor of the Bank of England to open up the term funding scheme to those alternative finance organisations, or open the doors of other lenders who can provide those schemes, those loans, to other SMEs?
Prime Minister.
Well, I thank my honourable friend. He raises an important point. Those, as he will know, the rules around access to schemes for alternative finance are not the responsibility of my right honourable friend, the Chancellor, but for the Bank of England. But I'm sure the Governor will have heard him today.
I'm sure the governor of the Bank of England will have heard him. Well, that's not really very giving any great commitment.
I'm a small businessman, actually. I've got my coffee shop in Portobello Road in London. And the first thing, of course, that you notice as a businessman, and probably anybody else as well, is that they're talking about loans. Well, loans have to be paid back, you know. Now, so if it's, you know, if you've just lost a heap of money due to lockdown, you know, why would you borrow a whole lot of money to cover that? You know, weren't we always told by Mrs. Thatcher that borrowing's a bad thing?
It's an interesting, isn't it, that the stock market and the property bubble has just been gifts. It's been gifts to the stock market, Martin, and yet we're being told small businesses that, well, you're going to have to pay it back, chum. The stock market doesn't have to, though.
Well, and the other thing, of course, is they're channeling it through the banks. If you were going to have a government-backed scheme of loans or whatever, you could have soft loans, for example, by the government. Mm. Why give it to the banks? That's just more. And of course, the banks have not picked up on this because there's no money in it for them, for the small businesses.
Yeah, the banks aren't interested.
They're just not interested in it, and so it's like pushing on a string to try and get the banks to lend to these small businesses. And as Ian points out, what use is a loan anyway? It's just, I mean, what you need to do is protect the economy through injecting demand. The obvious thing to do is have a generous universal credit, basic income.
Exactly.
Which would have been like an airbag. As we hit this wall, the airbag would have gone on, and the small businesses would then be survived as people spent money in small businesses, and you know that would have protected the economy. But we didn't do it,
and we know that that's right, because looking at it historically, the social security system that was introduced in 1945 by the left wing Labour government, you know, that's been credited with stabilising the economy, just because even those rather mean levels of support which people get helps to, you know, rebalance.
So why aren't we hearing any of this from Mr. Starmer, Martin?
Well, I mean, he's basically said pretty much the same sort of things as we've done, but very, very sotto voce. His political problem is he doesn't want to be seen. When he got elected, Boris Johnson had a massive opinion poll boost because he just got ill and everybody was rallying around the government. And therefore, he felt that he had to just kind of be seen to be constructive, but not to be too critical and so on. He's gradually finding that it's actually, you know, because Boris Johnson is frankly, even from his own side's point of view, are not a very good football player, things are moving in Starmer's direction.
Okay, we're going to go and to have some music in a minute. But before we finish, Kilmersdown and Mells this week, this is back in June. We missed this story completely, Martin, but John Bradenkamp apparently has died. This is this Rhodesian or Zimbabwe-born arms dealer that lives in Somerset that we have alleged on this programme has been involved in various dodgy deals to do with the Conservative Party and nuclear weapons used for fundraising for the Tories. Can you just say a little bit about Bradenkamp? Because we've got this quite an interesting little kind of, down at the villages of places like Kilmersdon and Mells, this kind of Rhodesian, rather right-wing contingent hanging around down there.
Yeah, and they're also married into the local Tory squirearchy and quite chummy with the Rees-Mogg family. Bradenkamp knows is very chummy with the Rees-Mogg family. Anyway, he supposedly died in Zimbabwe. He fought in the war.
Kidney failure, I think.
Yeah, he fought in the war in Zimbabwe. He was in the Rhodesian SAS along with his colleague Billy Reutenbach, who also lives in that part of the world. And we have information. We were given information that they were involved in the sale of South Africa's nuclear weapons at the end of apartheid. Now, there's a big story there. But anyway, the nuclear weapons were sold, but then they went missing. And the Tory party in 92 got lots of money on the back of that sale. I don't think we've got time to go into all the details.
No, but I wonder, is this story going to be buried with John Bradenkamp?
Well, the thing about this is, what my informant tells me is that he suspects that Bradenkamp isn't in fact dead.
Oh, God.
That in fact he lives in Mells and Kilmersdown, and but he's gone to Zimbabwe because he's not been back to Zimbabwe for years, but he's got loads of connections there. Therefore,
he's an interesting character in that he was quite friendly with Ian Smith, but then also with Mugabe.
Yes, because he's actually quite a. Anyway, the thing is,
he's involved with the BAE arms deals.
Yes, that's right. I mean, he's basically a very dodgy arms dealer. I mean, that's what he's known for. I mean, his assets have been frozen for a number of years. My informant tells me that that's probably because of the nuclear weapons.
Well, that
business.
Is interesting, isn't it? Because if he's died, surely those assets are now going to be unfrozen.
That's right. So therefore, it may well be that this is a fake death.
Oh, God.
And that in actual fact, he's still alive, but his will can now be enacted. And the because there's a massive gold bond in the Union Bank of Switzerland.
That's right, bullion bond.
Yeah, which is the proceeds of the nuclear weapons sale from years ago. And if he's by dying, inverted commas, that means that his assets can become unfrozen and he can pay off his creditors. Because the way this whole thing was financed is they went round the top of the Tory party in 1992 and said, you know what the deal is. You give us some money, and in 2 weeks' time, we're going to double your money. But don't ask us what we're doing.
So, does Jacob Rees-Mogg know about all this?
I'm reliably told that he does.
That's interesting, isn't it? It's actually an interesting thing to know about. Isn't there also a letter confirming some of this?
Yes.
Written by Tony Blair to Dan Norris, the former MP down there.
That's right. Now.
Because that letter would be an interesting bit of evidence, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Well, anyway, the point that just this all sounds terribly mysterious because we're not naming the source, but because he doesn't want to be named.
So we know it's a he.
Don't tell him, Pike.
I think they probably know who the source is. But anyway, so the long and short of it is Jacob could be wrapped up in this nasty little deal.
Well, I think the long and short of it, he is. And the point is that the whole Tory party got £17.5 million to spend. Was it £17.5 million? I think it was. On the 1992 election. And there was a question in the House of Commons, where did that money come from? And it was basically...
I think it was Tam Dio asked it, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah. And it came from the proceeds of this deal.
That's rather interesting. I mean, this is nuclear arms dealing. It's not... Is that a criminal offence?
Yes, it is. Magnus Milan approached... approached Bredenkamp and others and said, the blacks are about to take over in South Africa. We've got 9 nuclear warheads. There was 10, but one of them exploded in a test. But you don't want him to have them. We don't want him to have them. We are prepared to sell them to the Western powers. So both the British and the Americans agree that they would buy these warheads under the table. And the Americans brought 6 of them, and that left 3 that were to be bought by the British. But Bredenkamp interspersed himself into the next MI6 officer called Stephen Koch. They set up a company which was Astra.
Part of Astra Holdings.
Holdings, which was Astra Fireworks. And they paid for the 3 warheads. And then they sold them on to the British government at a profit. But, unfortunately, Bredenkamp double-crossed Astra Holdings and took the money and then didn't hand over the warheads. And they then disappeared into the black market. But at the same time, the Tory party itself was given a lot of money as a result of this, which helped them to win the 92 election.
I wonder how easy these nuclear weapons are to trace, because we don't really want nuclear weapons finding their way onto the black market, thank you very much, especially if it's used as a fundraising trick for the Conservative
Party. Well, indeed,
party.
So this is the real scandal underlying all of this. And there's also information that he may have actually got further plutonium warheads from a B-52 bomber that crashed off the coast of Somalia.
But then it could all be complete nonsense. Who knows?
Could. Mm. We'll be right back.